Well, how about an evening where you talk about Planet X, Nibiru, the Anunnaki 2012, the Dark Star Theory? Well, that's next with Andy Lloyd on Coast to Coast AM. What a night tonight. Andy Lloyd, researcher, author, paranormal investigator, holding a first-class science degree. Andy's research on Planet X or Nibiru raises the very real possibility that the sun is a tiny brown dwarf companion orbiting at a very great distance, which he describes as the Dark Star. Andy also has interests in UFOs, ghost hunting. He's appeared on numerous television and radio programs to discuss his theories, including Coast to Coast AM. Andy, how are you?
Oh, I'm absolutely fine this morning, George. Delighted to be on your program again.
So what's the weather in the UK these days?
It's been really, really cold this winter. We normally have it really, really mild, and this year's really broken the trend, and we've had lots and lots of snow. It's been freezing, freezing cold, and it seems quite a coincidence that we've had that this same year as the sun has decided to turn off the sunspots. So we're having ourselves a little mini ice age over here at the moment.
We might be in one now, Andy, I think. It's very possible. You've been traveling a lot these days, huh?
Yes. Normally I don't get out very much, you know, sad life and all that. But a couple of months ago I was invited to speak in Italy, in Rome, to a Planet X conference. George, there's not many Planet X conferences about that I know, really.
No, this is one of the first I've heard about, as a matter of fact.
So it was quite a surprise to be invited along, and you know, I made the trip, took my wife with me, and we had a great time in Rome. And what really surprised me, actually, was not only the numbers of people who turned up to attend, but also their sort of passion for the subject. They were really, really got into it. The Italians just seemed to love reading. They bought loads and loads of books about Planet X. They had really interesting questions, and they just sort of sat there really sort of taken with the whole subject. So it was a very uplifting experience. The only problem that we had was the actual travel in itself, because we had to sort of get across England in this blizzard to get to the airport, and all the roads were getting shut down, and we were, you know, the main road between us and Heathrow Airport was like a farm track, you know. I mean, I'm sure a lot of your listeners living in the continental parts of the USA are used to heavy amounts of snow and getting about, but in this country we're completely useless when the first snowdrop falls, you know, everything just shuts down. So that was a nightmare, but it was worth it. Rome's gorgeous, and it was a very, very good experience.
Who put the conference on? This is fascinating.
There's a magazine publisher out there. I can't remember what the Italian words are, but it's something to the effect of Signs in the Sky. And it's effectively a sort of Italian UFO magazine. I guess the Signs in the Sky idea also gives you the flavor that the Italians obviously have a more religious dimension to their ideas. And, you know, so it takes a very broad spectrum of sort of visionary experiences and so on. But they're very, very into conspiracy theory. You know, some of the Italian speakers were coming out with some very, very wild stuff. And, you know, they had what appeared to be, you know, I don't speak Italian, unfortunately, but what appeared to be an almost a dedicated following, really, the magazine. It was a superb conference, wonderfully organized and set within sort of a couple of miles of the Vatican. So you could go out onto the hill outside and stare across, and you could just about see St. Peter's Basilica in the distance, which was kind of funny. I find that quite ironic. You know, you could be sitting within sight of the Vatican talking about Planet X. It was a moment, I can tell you.
What were the overall views about Planet X, that it exists?
Yes. The views I picked up from the audience that surprised me somewhat, but I suppose in hindsight I shouldn't be surprised, was how really, really terrified they were about 2012 and the connection with Planet X. And, you know, a lot of the discussions that were going on were about survival and were about what would happen and when the government, if the government would tell us if there was a Planet X body incoming. A lot of the things were connected with those sort of strands, and people were really, really serious about this. This was obviously something that they'd put a lot of thought into and discussed in the magazine and on the internet for a long period of time. And that was the impression I walked away from, because my own experience in this country is that there's not a lot of talk about 2012. And I know that it is a big issue in America, and clearly it's a big issue in Italy. And so I was somewhat sort of, you're taken aback by that, but obviously it responded to it as well.
Andy, I want to talk about Ezekiel 1 in a moment, your new novel, which somehow ties into 2012. But also, it's kind of interesting that your work of The Dark Star is somewhat related as well. Let's review that for just a moment. Your thoughts on this Dark Star, this companion that we have some distance away from our own sun.
Yes, it's the idea, it goes back effectively to about the sort of mid-1980s. And as I'm going to be discussing later on in the show, George, the mid-1980s were kind of a crunch time for all of this. When astronomers were really interested in the idea of a nemesis object, which was the word they gave it, they thought at the time that this sort of sub-brown dwarf or brown dwarf object was orbiting the sun at a great distance and was capable periodically of throwing massive comet clouds our way, and that this would create sort of extinction events every 30 million years or so. So the astronomers were interested in this, and they were connecting it to sort of these extinctions, and there was a lot of interest in trying to find such an object within the astronomical community. Obviously, it had its skeptics, and to this day, this object has not been directly identified, although there are tantalizing clues. So during the sort of 1980s into the 1990s, the sort of wheel turned away from that, and there was a lot of skepticism in the community, in the scientific community, saying, look, you know, this is bunk, you know, there's nothing to this. Some very hardened debunkers were coming down hard on it. And in the last 10 years or so, funnily enough, since I sort of reproposed it in 1999, during that period of time, the pendulum swinging back round again. My idea was to say, look, you know, I think that, you know, if this object exists, that it would be capable of harboring life. You know, you could have this sort of warm Jupiter-sized planet out there, and it would be capable of having moons around it that would be habitable. So I said, that's very interesting, because if you take that idea and you combine that with Zechariah Sitchin's ideas about Nibiru,
right,
you create a context whereby that could work. You know, the Anunnaki wouldn't be sat on a freezing cold rock spinning, you know, way out of the sun, but would actually have a habitable environment. So this was the idea I put forward in 1999, and you know, it got published, and I started off my website and so on. And since then, somewhat to my surprise, I suppose, the scientific community have not exactly embraced the idea, because that they've not listened to me particularly, but they've discovered evidence, a tremendous amount of evidence, of anomalies in the outer solar system, because, you know, their ability to detect things in the outer solar system has improved. They've been looking at the Kuiper Belt objects and so on, and they found various anomalies that have really made them scratch their heads. And we're now sort of getting to a point now where the evidence is mounting that such an object is out there, because how else do you explain all these anomalies? So that's a potted history of the sort of dark star theory up to this point. And obviously, during the last 10 years, I've been collating this information and writing various articles and books about how the whole thing would work and why it could be a sort of good solution to a lot of the pieces of the jigsaw.
Well, and it's very possible. We're going to talk tonight with Andy about his views on 2012, which are somewhat different from the views that you just heard last hour with William Henry and Sriram Kaur. Now, back, if we can, to the work on Dark Star. How did you come up with the theories?
A lot of thinking. You know, I spend a lot of time walking to and from work and things, and these ideas go through my head, and it's a passion, really. Obviously, I read an awful lot of books. Zechariah Sitchin was a big favorite of mine in the sort of mid-90s, and I worked through all of his books. And I read a book by Alan Alford as well around about the same time called Gods of the New Millennium, which sort of took that idea forward a little bit further. Alan doesn't like his own book anymore. He sort of changed his mind somewhat.
Really? Different theory? Okay.
Yeah.
Well, that happens.
It does. I mean, he wrote a very, very successful book. It was published by Hodgson Stoughton. It did very, very well. And then a couple of years later, he decided that actually Zechariah Sitchin had got it wrong, and he had a different set of ideas he wanted to promote. He was sort of the catalyst for me to get into this. I started thinking, well, maybe, because Alford said, well, you know, Nibiru might have come around about the time of Jesus. You know, it might have come in during the Messianic era and being the Messianic star. And he sort of put that in as a little paragraph. And I thought, well, actually, that's kind of an interesting idea. Again, as you say, I've got slightly different views on timings from some of the people who were researching 2012. But that sort of got me thinking along those sort of lines. So, yes, I mean, we're all sat on a pyramid, and it grows. We stand on the shoulders of giants. I mean, I'm the first person to admit that the ideas I come across are based on the ideas of other people, in the sense that, you know, you can't just come up with an idea that's completely original. It's not connected with other people's. You read, and then you think, and then you take the idea forward, and it's like science. You know, sometimes someone will have an idea in science that is completely out there, like Einstein did, and that shakes everything up and throws it around. But the vast majority of people working in science is just add a little bit, another brick to an already increasing wall, and it just builds and builds and builds. So in that sense, my work is just putting a few more bricks on the wall and continuing to build up the theories that were pre-existing. I mean, it's also worth noting here that the idea of Planet X itself is over 100 years old. People were thinking about this. Yeah, people were thinking about this a long time ago.
Where do you think this dark star might be right now?
I think there's two distinct possibilities. My favoured position is the constellation of Sagittarius, which is in the southern sky to some degree. It's on the ecliptic. But there is always a possibility as well that it's in Orion, and a lot of people think it's in Orion, so I wouldn't rule that out.
Now, why? Let's say when we launch the Kepler on Friday, this incredible piece of machinery here, that will be looking for Earth-sized planets, might we be able to find objects like the dark star?
It's possible that that particular survey isn't looking for objects of that ilk. There are surveys that are going up that are designed to find something like a dark star. IRAS, back in the mid-1980s, was specifically looking for things like that, warm objects, because something that doesn't emit a lot of light but does emit heat, you can't see it particularly, hence the dark star name. But you should be able to pick up a heat signature of that object against the background of what is practically, you know, zero Kelvin. So if you're looking for it, infrared is the way to go. And, of course, it's very, very difficult to look for objects in infrared from the ground on Earth, because the atmosphere that surrounds us, even on a cold day...
Too much clutter.
Yeah, I mean, you just can't find it. So if you're on Earth and you need to use an infrared scope, you've got to go to somewhere extremely cold, like Antarctica or on the top of a mountain in Chile or something. But if the best way to do it would be to get satellites up and look for it that way. And strangely enough, and I'm not sure it is strange particularly, but there hasn't been any particular work done in this way since 1983 when IRIS went up, which is a long time, 25 years. But now they are putting two pieces up called the SIRTF, which is a sort of an updated infrared scope, and also WISE, which is the second thing, which will predominantly look for brown dwarfs. That is specifically designed to pan the sky for brown dwarfs. Those two should be within their capability to spot this object, and that will be in the next few years.
All right, the sun is 93 million miles away from planet Earth. How far is this dark star?
Well, you take the 93 million miles, and what the astronomers do is call that one astronomical unit. So that's your sort of baseline. It's, you know, if you want to measure in miles, you measure in miles, but we measure it in that. The dark star, I suspect, is probably between about sort of 500 and 1,000 astronomical units. It's a long, long way. It's sat between the Kuiper belt and the edge of the hypothetical Oort cloud, which is the comet clouds beyond, and there is a big sort of band, a big gap there where there's nothing there, and that's where this object resides. It's its domain, and it's been sweeping it out and clearing it out and making this empty region of space around it.
Boy, it's just so far out, Andy. How could it have any effect on this planet?
Well, the Sun and the dark star have got very, very significant fields attached to them. The Sun's gravitational effect runs out to about half a light year. I mean, it's significant. You know, some of the comets that go around the Sun are way, way out there. I mean, they're sort of 20,000 astronomical units, and they're still managing to get around the Sun. So these two bodies can affect each other in ways beyond just simply having to have it come bang something. You know, their magnetic fields, their gravitational fields, they can interact. And the Sun has sort of field boundaries, which I think interact with this dark star. And, you know, this dark star is going to have a very significant magnetic field. Jupiter has a very significant magnetic field. If you went outside and you looked up into the night sky and you looked at Jupiter from Earth, and it's a beautiful white star in the sky, and when it's in, you know, when it's at its best, it's sort of as bright as Venus. If you had a look at it and you were able to see its magnetic field, the magnetic field of Jupiter would be a sort of a blaze across the sky that would be four times the size of the Sun disk, which is huge.
Yes.
So if you look at it in that context, if you're talking about a sort of sub-brown dwarf, which is a couple of times the size of Jupiter, or a few times, maybe three, four, five, that's going to be even greater. That magnetic field is free to interact with the Sun and to cause some interesting effects. And indeed, it may already have been measured, that effect.
And do you believe most stars have a brown dwarf with it?
Yes.
A companion?
Yes. I mean, most stars in the galaxy, as far as we're aware, are not singular stars, but binaries. Our Sun, in the idea of it being a sole star, is a very unusual situation. And the problem with this idea, George, is that it's very difficult to spot these objects. If they're very, very close to the stars, they can be seen because of the effect that they create. You know, they cause the stars to wobble a little bit, and astronomers can pick them up. But when you're talking about an object that's what's called a wide binary, which is what this would be.
These are big. These are pretty big, aren't they?
Yeah, they're pretty big. But if they're very, very far away, then the net effect upon their sort of parent stars is only a tiny little wobble, if anything much at all. So you can't see them either by looking for them or for seeing the effect. They have to be very close to their stars. So if you're talking about something that's, say, 500 astronomical units away from the Sun, they're effectively invisible. Now, my belief is, and it's my belief, but my belief is that when stars are formed, they are formed in a sort of a college, a little cluster of objects together. And these wide binaries are simply, you know, a function of the way stars are born in stellar nurseries. And it seems to me to make an awful lot of sense. It's common sense from my point of view that each star would have lots of stragglers.
We're going to tie in 2012 with Planet X. When we come back, we're going to be talking about his latest work as well, Ezekiel 1, Andy's website, Dark Star 1, that's with the numeral 1, darkstar1.co.uk. It's linked up right now at coasttocoastam.com. We'll be right back. Well, Andy sent us some graphics depicting the dark star if you want to go look at them at coasttocoastam.com. Are you a Streamlink member yet? For just pennies a day, you can podcast and download past programs as well. Just go to coasttocoastam.com and you can sign up for Streamlink. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. I'm George Norrie. We're with Andy Lloyd, who's out there in the United Kingdom as we speak. Andy, 2012, do you see a connection with that year and Planet X?
I think it's fair to say that the Mayan age, or the cycle of over 5,000 years, the most likely explanation for that is something astronomical. For a period that long, it's difficult to look at it in any other way. It has the connotations of the return of something, whether it would be a comet or some kind of cyclical event to do with the solar system. So in that respect, I think, yes, I think that there is something going on within the solar system that creates that period of time. Now, it's a very, very strange thing, the Mayan prophecy. Really, really odd. The ages, the beginning and the end, were set outside the parameters of the civilization that thought of it. So the Mayans sat, several thousand years ago. Their age begins a couple of thousand years before they were around, their civilization was around, and ends again another couple of thousand years. They're sat right in the middle of this thing. You could argue, if they managed to predict their own demise, that would have been quite useful to them. But they came up with this 2012 date and the period before 3114 BC. So where those two dates came from, absolutely no one knows. Now, the 3000 BC date was it was quite a significant period of time in the sort of birth of civilization in the world. The Egyptians were getting their act together around about that time. The Mesopotamians were already up and running. There was some great changes afoot in the world at that time. The civilizations were really emerging. So it has significance, and it may well be that if you're interested in sort of the ideas of the Anunnaki, for instance,
sure,
there may have been a pivotal period around about that time where there was some kind of intervention, and that's why they set the date.
And you believe that there was intervention?
Personally, yes. I think that there... It makes sense of an awful lot of things. I don't think we're alone in the universe. I don't think we're even alone in our local neighbourhood. I think we're sat on Earth, sort of merrily going our way in blissful ignorance. And outside of our planet, there are people keeping an eye on us and possibly managing us a little bit. I mean, I wouldn't put that beyond the realm of possibility. Intervention back in time makes sense. So, George, one of the things I often think about, and I've never really come up with an answer for this, is that humans, modern humans, have been around about 130,000 years. But during that time, for the vast majority of that time, even though they're exactly like we are now and we're capable of having the same kind of conversations as we're having now, the complexity of our language and our minds is, shows great potential for all that time. Why is it only in the last 5,000 years or so that we managed to get our act together? So, I've often thought that something triggered these events, something moved us on. So in that way, if the Mayans had held some kind of oral record through the Olmecs or so on, that some sort of record that back in 3000 BC, there was a significant event and that there was a promise of another event in 2012, then it's on our doorstep, and it's a very, very exciting time.
And somebody must have helped them, Andy.
Yeah, I think
I'm sure they were advanced, but somebody must have helped them.
You only have to look at the monolithic structures of Central and South, particularly South America. I don't want to get into sort of pyramidology or what have you, but some of the ancient structures that we find on this planet are just absolutely incredible. They're way beyond what we understand the ancient people's capabilities were. And often they just arose out of nothing. I mean, the Great Pyramid in Egypt is an absolute classic example. And it almost appears that all the other pyramids were sort of an afterthought, like, oh, yeah, that's how you do it, right? Let's try and knock this up. Oh, it's not quite as good. But, that something... Those kind of engineering projects in Giza and I always love this sexy woman. I love that in South America. You look at those structures and you think, there's a hand behind that development that goes beyond a sort of an agrarian people who are sort of gleaning a basic living off the land. Some things happen there. So 2012 is potentially very significant. Slightly take a different opinion from a lot of people researching this at the moment is that I'm unconvinced it means that there's a very sizable planet bearing down on us. But that isn't to say that there aren't other effects in the solar system that we're at the moment unaware of that could happen within a few years.
Do you think governments are aware of this Planet X?
Yes, I do.
Why the secrecy then?
Well, I think that... Do you want me to run through the way I think about
yeah,
it?
Yeah, absolutely.
I was sort of sitting down about 20 minutes before the show started, trying to sort of collect my thoughts on this. And I'll, you know, part of it is sort of the workings behind the idea for Ezekiel 1, which we're going to talk about. But I think it would be quite a good idea to sort of put forward how I think all this sort of worked out.
Okay.
Back in the mid-80s, IRAS, the infrared astronomical telescope that was put up into space, appears to have found one or possibly two candidate objects of the kind of thing I've been talking about this evening. And this is well known, and this isn't something I'm just throwing out. It's well known, and it's well known because they announced it. You know, they went to the press, either got leaked into the press or someone in the office phoned up someone at the Washington Post and said, hey, look, we've got a story here. And it's well documented. You know, people can have a look in Zechariah Sitchin's Genesis Revisited, and he discusses this quite a bit. Anyway, back in 1983, the end of, the articles came out saying, we think, NASA thinks it's found a Jupiter-sized object that's close enough to be orbiting the Sun, which is a very, very significant discovery. And over time, that claim was gradually watered down. So they said, okay, maybe it's not Jupiter, maybe it's the Neptune-sized object. Okay, maybe it's not a Neptune-sized object. Maybe it's a galaxy very far away. And, I mean, how would you pick up a galaxy in infrared? You know, they were just throwing ideas out to try and water the story down. But, you know, it made the press, and a lot of astronomers got excited about it, and they wrote in their columns about it, oh, yes, it looks like NASA's on the verge of announcing the discovery of Planet X. And then nothing stopped. IRAS kind of carried on its work. The people there were working through the data for a long period of time. Mm-hmm. And then it stopped. It ran out of funds or what have you. And the two, as I mentioned before, Sagittarius and Orion, the two major anomalies that were picked up that seemed to be argued about and became publicly contentious at the time, those anomalies were sort of swept under the carpet and people went back and said, oh, no, it was nothing. Don't worry about it. Now, I've often been intrigued by the fact that around about that time that came up, the Nemesis idea came up, and then only a few years later, President Reagan, bless his cotton socks, stood up in front of the United Nations General Assembly and was speaking effectively indirectly towards Mr. Gorbachev and said, look, you know, what would happen if we found out that there were space aliens out there? You know, we'd get our act together and we'd become friends and sort the world out.
And they were coming after us, basically.
Yes. Exactly. And within a year or so, the Soviet Union sort of admitted defeat. I know there were a great many economic arguments, but economic arguments have never been too much of a problem for the Soviets. And they, you know, they said, OK, well, we'll throw our towel in with the West and let's try and become a Western democracy. So it was almost like those things were connected, you see. So in my sort of conspiracy theory mind, the whole thing builds up. So President Reagan, unfortunately, as all your readers, listeners are aware, succumbed to Alzheimer's disease. He picked it up in 1994, or it became a particular problem. He was diagnosed in 1994, and unfortunately, 10 years later, he died, although he lived to a ripe old age. And he's a very beloved president, I recognize. But there were hints, even back in the 1980s, that he was already having short-term memory problems.
Mm-hmm.
And he managed to get through to the end of his office, okay, that was no problem. But he was already starting to say things to his medics to the effect of, you know, my memory's not what it used to be, and he used to make jokes about it. So what I think may have happened is that somewhere in all of that, Mr. Reagan, back in 83, 84, while he was president, was made aware that this object was out there, and a decision was taken that shouldn't be told to the public because of the potential for life, intelligent life, being discovered on our doorstep and the potential for it to actually be a threat to us. So the whole thing got locked down, and Mr. Reagan was probably not kept in the loop particularly about how all that happened, but at some point towards the end of his presidency, he slightly got a little bit muddled and decided to talk about this in front of the United Nations, hence why we found out about it. You know, then the next president was Mr. Bush, who was obviously a very safe pair of hands because he was the next director of the CIA. and served as director of the CIA.
Yeah, I'm sure if there was anything to know, he knew it.
Exactly, and he was also the man to make sure that if anything needed to be kept secret, that there would be, you know, ways and means of shutting stories down and making sure that we didn't find out about it. Because, you know, George, there's only three certainties in life. There's death, there's taxes, and there's government secrecy. You know, governments hold secrets, all of them do. The British government's fantastic at holding secrets. They'll hold on to stuff for 50 years, 100 years. They'll just keep on putting it back. And the American government's no different. Other governments in the world seem to be a little bit more open. Chinese very into UFOs. Russians very into UFOs. They're more open to it, and their governments will allow the subject to be discussed openly. But in the West, we tend to want to just stop that sort of activity, and it's almost a subversive activity to be talking about UFOs in this country.
Well, Andy, you believe in the Anunnaki. Mm. Where are they coming from? Because I don't think they're coming from a brown dwarf, are they?
Well, they're, like I was saying, the solar system probably contains lots of stragglers. I don't think our understanding of the solar system is complete at all.
No, I don't think so either.
We understand it up to about 50 astronomical units, which is the edge of the Kuiper Belt. Really, our knowledge of the solar system only extends out just beyond Pluto. Everything beyond that is just darkness. And we only find out about these comets because they periodically come into our sight. They approach us and say, hi, here we are, and then they go off again. We can't see them all the way out there, and the field of comets is hypothetical. And yet, the extent of the sun's influence is absolutely massive. So there is the potential out there for any number of objects, really. And you could have Mars-sized objects, Earth-sized objects, Neptune-sized objects, and this dark star object that I speak about. So it's quite possible that you've got several objects swinging around the sun that could act as bases or stepping stones or in the terminology of the Sumerians, as ferries. You know, these objects could be floating around, and they just basically jump from one to another to get wherever they want. Carl Sagan used to talk about, back in the early 80s, I think it was, he used to say, if you want to go to another star, don't build a great big spaceship. You hitch a ride on interstellar comet. You know, you send a spaceship, you find an interstellar comet that's heading in the direction you want. It's like jumping on a train. You jump on the train, you core out the comet, you live inside it for several generations as your own little planet, and it will take you where you want to go. And in a way, I think the Anunnaki can do this. So the idea of Nibiru may be some kind of traditional Planet X object in a sort of 3,600.
Okay, so we have a lot of stuff out there then, the brown dwarf star, the planet, or several planets.
There's any number of, and this is the problem with the subject, because the data that we have to work from myths and so on, is ambiguous. It's very, very difficult to pin it down and say, this is exactly what it is. We know that from the ancient texts that when Sitchin's object, what she calls Nibiru or Marduk, came into the solar system and started knocking things around and reshaping the solar system, we know it was a huge fiery object with moons. And to my mind, that was the dark star. You know, that was a very significant Jupiter-sized body that came into the solar system and caused a bit of an accident back about 4 billion years ago. But then since then, the solar system settled right down, and it's become a relatively stable environment. So the chances of that same object continually coming in every 3,600 years and potentially pounding the solar system, it doesn't seem very likely, because our solar system would look a lot more chaotic than it does now. But it is true to say that if you're talking about an object like Nibiru coming in, then there may be a smaller object that's associated between two systems, acting as sort of ferry between the two. And that could be something that does indeed return every 3,600 years.
Do you believe the Anunnaki might be threatening to us?
I cannot. If their existence were to be confirmed, I cannot see how else you could possibly take it. I mean, looking at the history as described of them and the way they acted when they were on this planet, that they were a lot like us, only a bit more scary. You know, they used to have their own little fiefdoms. They'd create human armies that would go and fight each other. According to Sitchin, they even dropped a bomb at one point. I mean, they're a very sort of war-loving people. And then they seem to have left. And you know, part of Sitchin's sort of work is to discuss that, you know, Nibiru came through and it caused the flood, you know, which is the biblical
flood. Great flood, yeah.
Yeah, and the Anunnaki basically, to almost to a man, stood back and said, actually, this is probably quite a good idea because it will wipe the slate clean and humans are getting out of control and they've proven a bit difficult to control and we'll just wipe it out and start again. And then, you know, humanity was saved. And this is how the myth goes. I'm not advocating this as a historical reality necessarily, but this is how the myth goes. But the myths are based on something. And, you know, it gives you an indication of their almost contempt for us. You know, they created us as domesticated animals to do their bidding. And if they were to return, they'd want to carry on where they left off. They're not going to come here and go, oh, yeah, humans, you're great. Let's have a pact with you. Let's do trading. They'd come back and say, actually, we're your gods. We're in charge. It's time that you started paying us some respect. And you and I might, if that situation happened, we might panic a bit and think, well, what's our leaders going to say to that? But believe me, George, our leaders would be just, you know, their whole power base would be completely eradicated. Know whether they've got this sort of dominant position within a social hierarchy on our planet. Should an alien species come here and take over control, that's it for them. They're on the same level as the rest of us then. So they've got a lot to lose. And, you know, that's a good motivating factor for them to keep the story quiet, keep it shut down, and, you know, make sure that people like me don't get hold of the story and start, you know, getting people thinking about other possibilities.
I've always wondered if the Anunnaki came here, why they left, or where they are.
There appears to have been a power struggle between them towards the end of their stay here. And, it, you know, the wars of God and men, Sitchin wrote about. And there was also a sort of a difference of opinion about our place in the world. One thing that happened with us, of course, is that we started to propagate massively. Our population expanded. And I suspect that what happened was we just simply got out of control. There were just far too many of us. But there were, I think, only supposed to be about 600 of them here. You know, they were a colony. And although they were very powerful and very
brilliant
at what they did, at the end of the day, the numbers start to count. And as our population rose into sort of the millions and then the hundreds of millions, eventually, we would have become too unwieldy and too dangerous. So I strongly suspect that's what happened, that they made the conscious decision at one point, look, you know, we can't carry on here because at some point we're going to succumb to the very people that we've given these freedoms to.
I wonder if they monitor us, though.
Oh, yes. Yes, yes, yes. I mean, again, this particular scenario, whether you buy into it or not, I mean, it is quite a speculative scenario, but it gives you the potential to understand why, say, UFOs come down, why there's alien abductions and so on, because if they meddled with our genetic history and they created us from lower beings, then that meddling could be ongoing, and, of course, they'd want to monitor the progress.
Up next, Andy Lloyd talks about 2012. His novel, his work, is called Ezekiel 1. Is it fiction based on fact?